Hi guys, I am still at home, which is really, really nice. This week though, I did actually do a little bit of travel. I went down to Sydney and recorded a couple of play-by-play courses. Now, for those of you who are in other parts of the world, going to Sydney is a little bit like, let's say if you're in London and you're going further than Amsterdam, I don't know, maybe like to somewhere in Germany or somewhere like that. It's about an hour and a quarter flight. Now, an hour and a quarter in an airplane in Australia gets you about this far down a map that's about that big. So we don't actually get very far. But Sydney is sort of, I guess, our biggest city where most of the things happen. And the folks that I was recording courses with were down around that way as well. So I'm not going to talk too much about what those courses are. I'm going to wait until they come out later on. But regardless, I went down to Sydney. Melbourne's next week. Don't mess those up. So I went down to Sydney just for a day trip. It's nice here, actually, because it's sort of a half-hour drive down to our little local domestic airport, down to Sydney, went straight out into the recording studio, did these two courses on security-related things, different angles, straight back in the car to the airport, home, job done, I was home for dinner, which was actually really, really nice. So I'm going to try and do more of those local Australia things like I did earlier this week, because it's just so much easier than the international stuff. But having said that, there is other stuff coming up. I mentioned last week I'm off to the US in 2 weeks and one day, actually. So check out last week's update if you're interested in where I'll be then. So I did that one. That's all good. A couple of other interesting things coming up next week. Thursday next week, I'm doing a free webinar on the Australian Notifiable Data Breach Scheme, our NDB scheme, which is effectively our mandatory disclosure laws. Now, there's some good stuff about them. There's some stuff I'd like to see done differently. I'm doing this free webinar for a company called Fortinet. I'm going to put a link. I've already got a draft link in the references for this blog post. So if you want to tune into that, you can. I suspect it's going to be recorded, so hopefully you'll be able to see that later on. It's going to be about 20, 25 minutes worth of talking and then a whole bunch of questions. So come and join that if you want to as well. I think the whole premise of mandatory disclosure is good. And then there's some discussion about, does it go far enough and what are the gaps left as well? So I've written all that up. I've just got to obviously do the thing, but you can tune into that next week. All right, so intro-wise, I think that will do us there. Oh, I did mention I'm going to be in Melbourne next week as well. So I'm in Melbourne on Tuesday. I'm going to check. I'm not sure if it's a public event or not. It is a commercial thing that they're flying me down to do. If it's public, I'll put a link into my notes. And if it is and you're in Melbourne, we can come and say good day. All right, so there are two big blog posts I wrote this week. And in fact, I wrote the second one first. And my plan was I was going to push this second one out on Monday, and it would be a good read, and that would be great. And then I'd just do other work and stuff during the day on Monday. And then something happened which totally blew all that out of the water. And I actually think this is a very, very important event, a watershed event, for want of a better term, in terms of what it told us about the way we're building web apps. And the first time I knew about this is I got up Monday morning my time, because we're in the future. It was still yesterday in other parts of the world. It was still yesterday in the UK. And I got up and I had my mate Scott Helm sending me all these messages going, "You're not going to believe what has happened. Like, have a look at your Twitter feed." And I've had a look at my Twitter feed, and I'm going to link to the blog post. It's got a lot of these embedded in there as well. And Scott's the first tweet I noticed from him here is he screen capped a couple of screens from the ICO in the UK, the Information Commissioner's Office. And the screen cap says, or his comment under it says, "So yeah, this is bad. I just had Fat Hobbit," Fat Hobbit is another Twitter account, "point out that ICO News has a crypto miner installed on their site." Now, let's just talk about crypto miners for a second, because this is kind of an interesting discussion. And the crypto miners in this context here are crypto miners that run via JavaScript, predominantly CoinHive. Now, you can go to coinhive.com and using their service, you can embed a crypto miner in your website so that when people come to your site, you can monetize just a little bit of their CPU power to mine a bit of Monero coin. Now, I'm trying to think of the right words to explain how I feel about this. And it's not that I feel completely negative about this as well. Let me just put it into context. So here's the value proposition they put forward. Let's start there and then we'll argue about whether it's good or not. Their value proposition is, particularly in an era when it is increasingly difficult to monetize traffic, predominantly because ads basically got so crap that so many people run ad blockers, something like a third of people run ad blockers. So they're not seeing ads. So websites are going, how do we monetize? And CoinHive is saying, okay, well, the way you can monetize is that you can put this little crypto miner in there and you get to mine a little fraction of a Monero coin when someone comes to your site. I believe, and someone will probably tell me I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that Monero is something that can actually be mined via CPU with some degree greater efficiency than, say, trying to mine Bitcoin or something. So their value proposition is that you can monetize your customers in that way. And then the negative impact on the user who comes to the site is that their CPU spikes a bit. While they're there with that tab open and close the tab, all gone. Now, the bit that I feel uncomfortable about is, first of all, is that once people run an ad blocker, they're going to be blocking CoinHive anyway, so there's that. Second of all, there's just something that feels kind of dirty about your CPU being used to mine currency for someone else's financial benefit. And I can't put it in more definable terms insofar as that there's not a direct security risk to you, there's not a cost other than maybe you need to use a bit more power because your CPU is working a bit harder, but it's like you're never going to notice it. But it just feels dirty, right? To have a crypto miner running on your machine. Now, in legitimate use cases, someone who has a website is saying, we're going to put the crypto miner on here so that when people come to our site, that's why we're going to monetize it. And that is a conscious decision by the website to do that. And CoinHive does exist in a legitimate space. I'm not doing air quotes for the people listening to the audio because I don't think there's anything illegal or irresponsible about it. Maybe irresponsible, maybe immoral, but you get the point, right? It's stood up to do this and a website can opt into it. I've seen someone screen capture an image and tweeted it recently where one particular website they went to, they didn't have an ad blocker, or rather the person had an ad blocker running. And then the website said, oh, you've got an ad blocker. Could you please either turn it off and see our ad or click here so that we can mine coin in your browser? And it just feels dirty, doesn't it? You know, like it feels like a shitty thing to do to your customers. But again, all of that is opt-in, it's conscious. Now, what we have been seeing over many months is we have been seeing websites get compromised. So someone has literally broken into the site by one means or another. So for example, SQL injection, dodgy WordPress add-on, whatever else has left it open. Let's say reflected cross-site scripting. Another good example. Not reflected. Persistent cross-site scripting. Another good example where someone can get this CoinHive script to run in the context of the browser. So we've seen malicious attacks where someone's website that never wanted to have CoinHive on it now has CoinHive. And then people come past that website and suddenly there's crypto mining happening in their browser. So we started to see that. So obviously there's malicious purposes. And to be clear as well, short of having very, very large volumes of traffic, you're not making any money out of this. It's tiny, tiny amounts of money. Yeah, like single digit dollars, maybe double digits if you get really, really lucky and have huge exposure. And you've got to literally break the law and break into someone's site to do it. So yeah, not a whole lot of upside. So we've seen this happening, but what happened on the weekend was quite different because, first of all, Scott tweeted this from the ICO and was sort of going, okay, well, has the ICO been hacked, right? So have they got a SQL injection vulnerability or a persistent cross-site scripting vulnerability? And then as we scroll down and we look at Scott's other tweets, we see other examples of other sites that suddenly are serving up CoinHive as well. And the thing is that ICO is government. And Scott pointed to other government sites, such as the US courts, such as my own state government here in Queensland and Australia, also serving up CoinHive. And he's sort of going, you know, but by the time I woke up and saw this, he'd figured it out. But he's sort of going, you know, what is going on here? And what he's worked out is that there is a company called TextHelp. And TextHelp makes a product called Browse Aloud. And Browse Aloud is an accessibility add-on that you can plug into your site. Government sites in particular where there are regulations where they need to be accessible use this tool. The way you embed this tool is you include their JavaScript in your site. So there's like a script tag, embed from BrowserLoud, that script tag gets loaded from their site, run in your site, and then that adds the functionality. And as people come to your website who might be, say, visually impaired, they've got this functionality where they can do text-to-speech and stuff like that. So this is the model of how it works. And unfortunately, what had happened is the JavaScript from BrowserLoud had been modified. And Scott's actually got some neat screen caps he shared, and I've got them in embedded pastebins in my site, which shows that effectively what was happening was same old BrowserLoud script, same old comments about heading. Just under that, there's a window document write, and then it just writes out a script tag. Coinhive.com/ blah, 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 blah. And Coinhive is literally embedded into that script. And then by virtue of thousands of other websites embedding that script, you've now run Coinhive across all of these sites at once. Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because we're saying this is bad. Everyone agrees it's bad. There is a discussion to be had about how that JavaScript got modified in the first place. So, for example, did someone gain access to it in storage and change it there, which is probably the most likely explanation. But how do we stop this from happening in future? Now, in this case, a whole bunch of people had Coinhive running in their browser for a little bit. TextAloud then figured out what happened. And in fact, they pulled the entire service offline. So rather than just fixing the file, they're just like, no, we'll just nuke it all together. Which, of course, would have broken the functionality of BrowserLoud on every single site embedding it. But that's another issue. How do we stop this bigger problem? Because the bigger problem is you've got thousands of websites creating an external dependency on this file that runs somewhere else, and anyone can potentially change it. Let me rephrase that. If someone changes it, such as via modifying the original source file, then it cascades down to every single website. Now, we've got a couple of different technologies to deal with this, and one of those technologies is SRI, so sub-resource integrity. And one of the really interesting things about SRI is very few people know it exists. And I know this because I go to conferences and I present about SRI, and I go to workshops and I teach people about SRI, and they're like, this is cool, we've never seen this before. And in very simple terms, SRI is an integrity check. So what you can do is you can take a JavaScript file that you trust. Let's say it's jQuery. A lot of websites got jQuery. So you take jQuery version 2.2.3 minified version, and you create, say, a SHA-256 hash of it. Okay, so now you have this SHA-256 hash value. You put that value as an attribute on your script tag. So the script tag that embeds that particular file, so you've got script source, my jQuery version, then you have an integrity attribute, you put the hash there. You can have your source attribute pulling that JavaScript file off, say, Cloudflare's CDN. When the browser pulls it in, it goes, oh, you got an integrity attribute on the tag, let's hash the file we've just pulled in and compare it. If they're identical, we run it. Now, this is beautiful because what it's doing is it's saying, I can pull that file from anywhere in the world, whether I trust them or not. And if that file is not precisely the one that I expect to see, based on the integrity attribute on the tag, then just don't run it. And that kills this sort of stuff absolutely flat out dead gone. It works in Firefox and Chrome. It is going to work in the next generation of Edge. I'm just double checking. It does also work in the current version of Safari. Doesn't work in Edge 16, will work in Edge 17. So we do have a gap with the Microsoft browsers there, which is unfortunate, but being fixed. So this is awesome. Like, why don't we just do this everywhere? Well, there's a number of problems here. So one of the problems is that you need to ensure that the script file is never going to change. Because if you put an integrity attribute and you say it must look precisely like this, and then the third party serving it changes it, well, now you've got a problem. It's not going to run. We've got to divide this discussion down now into two parts, where one part is, let's say you're serving jQuery 2.2.3, minified version, and you've got an integrity attribute, and you're serving it from Cloudflare, or rather embedding it from Cloudflare. That's never going to change. That is static. If there's a new version, it'll get revved in the file name. So there'll be 2.2.4, or they're up to 3 point something now. And what that means is that you're still going to be requesting the old version. You're not going to get the benefit of the new version. And keep in mind, sometimes they're breaking changes too, which is part of the reason why you wouldn't want them upgrading something like jQuery with just a reference directly through to the file and no version. So the integrity attribute works there because you're always getting a specific version of the file. And that file does not change. That would fundamentally break the whole premise of having the file versioned. So that's our one route. The other route is when you are embedding a service. So let's take Disqus. At the bottom of my blog, I've got Disqus. And I embed Disqus by calling a JavaScript file off their site. That JavaScript file then calls other images and iframes and other visual assets. And if you look at what happens down at the bottom of my browser where you see, or bottom of my site, where you see Disqus being embedded, you'll see that there's actually a lot of stuff here. And then when you click submit, it hits one of their API endpoints and I get a response that the script then interprets and displays whatever it needs to on the page. You know, thank you, your comment has been submitted. So there is an entire black box of service behind that one JS reference. And this is what happens with BrowseLoud as well. And the problem now is that when you embed BrowseLoud or Disqus, you are not embedding one perfectly versioned file of like a standalone library. You're embedding an entire service. And Disqus or BrowseLoud may turn around tomorrow and change the implementation of that library. Because they could say, for example, we found a bug, we want to fix it, we want everyone to get the benefit of that. Now, okay, in a case like that, you could argue maybe you should upgrade the version. But what happens if they turn around and say, we're actually changing things like API endpoints that our library references? But because we can control the entire ecosystem, we can change the library references and the API endpoints. Maybe we're going to change the object type that one of the API returns, but we can do that because we control the script that's embedding it. So you see that the point we're getting to here is that you are embedding an entire service. You can't just sort of take one little part out of that and version it and then have everything else sort of work around that. And then every time there's a new version, suddenly have all of these supported at the same time whilst other things in the background change. And Scott and I had a bit of a heated debate about this because Scott's saying, yeah, you can just version it. I don't think you can because in a case like Disqus, there's a couple of things here. Number one is how many versions of their service should they support at once? So this is not like saying here is a static library and we don't have to support it because it's just a file that sits here on the file system, you download it. You'd be saying here is Disqus version 1.0.0 through to 1.0.20. And each one of these has slightly different dependencies on backend services. Do we have to keep supporting all of those backend services in different versions? Like it starts to get enormously complex. And even if you did version that one JavaScript file, a lot of them then embed other files and other iframes and other things from the host. So you start to get into this real messy situation, which is that you can't on the one hand say, I want to embed a service and it's a black box and they just embed it how they want. And then on the other hand say, but the file must always be exactly this file. So this is the paradox we've got. And in fact, the title of the blog post was the JavaScript supply chain paradox. And it is a difficult one. We can't just solve it with SRI. We can solve it with CSP. And I've spoken a lot about CSP before. Obviously, Scott and I run the Report URI service, so we have a vested interest in people using CSP and reporting back to us. But be that as it may, it is a technology that solves this. And by pure coincidence, we both had writing in draft about how content security policies can help solve this crypto mining scourge that we're seeing being embedded into sites. Because what we can do with a CSP is we can say, you can only load script from, say, these domains. All right, so you would return either a response header or a meta tag on your site that has your content security policy in it and says, this web page is only allowed to embed scripts from, say, Google Analytics and Disqus and Cloudflare CDN. And if one of those scripts gets compromised and CoinHive gets added into it and the browser tries to make a request to CoinHive.com, the content security policy will block it. So in a case like BrowseLoud, what you'd really like to be able to do is say, let's have a CSP that allows us to embed a script from BrowseLoud, but nowhere else. And then when Browse Aloud gets owned and there's a reference in there to try and embed a script from CoinHive, it just simply won't happen. Now, your CSP would also have to recognize that in Browse Aloud's implementation, they also need to get images, say from these three different domains, because they might have some of them on a CDN or something. You probably also need to get CSS. In a case of Browse Aloud where there's audio for text-to-speech, you've probably got to be able to get media. And all of these are different content types: scripts, images, styles, media. And this is what your CSP does. It says, here are the places you can get them from. This solves the problem. Like, it solves it fantastically. And the problem that we still have here is that you need someone like Browse Aloud not to change their internal implementation later on and start requesting things from other hosts you haven't whitelisted. So what I would love to see is a model where someone like Browse Aloud says, this is the way to embed our service, the way we're doing it at the moment. These are the hosts that you need to whitelist in your CSP if you want to do that, if you want to have a CSP. And we make a commitment not to suddenly add a new host which is in there, which is not in there. I think that's the way it should work. I actually emailed some people at Discuss yesterday. So after me having to do responsible disclosure to Discuss about them having been breached, I have some friends there. So I emailed them and said, look, I would love you guys to do this. Could you please, on your page which says this is how you embed Discuss, put a sample CSP. I even wrote one for them. I took the one off my website. Because at the moment, if they go and start requesting stuff from another host name, it's going to break Discuss on my blog. And I don't want that to happen. I would rather we all agree, here are the places that Discuss is going to embed stuff from, put it in the CSP. Now, there's another angle to this though, because if Discuss did change their implementation and start embedding things from a different host name, not within my CSP whitelist, because I have got a report URI directive and I'm sending reports to Scott and my service, I can actually see when they break it. And yes, they'd break it, and yes, it would stop working for some people, but I'd know about it really, really soon, so I could go and fix it. And this is what's so cool about CSPs and reporting. So this is the summary to everything. I would love to see SRI integrity attributes on any resource where the file is static and it doesn't change. Fixes this problem straight away. I would love to see content security policies on both that, so allowing you to load that script, which then has the SRI attribute, and I'd love to see CSPs on embedded services such as Browse Aloud and Discuss. That solves this problem. One final thing. Because people on the internet can get very passionate about this stuff, a number of people popped up after I wrote this blog post and after the whole debacle and said, you should never embed anything from anywhere else. And in fact, there are a couple of schools of thought here. This was one of them. And the other school of thought was, you should never use any external dependencies at all, like stuff that other people have written. And I want to tackle both of these. And in fact, we might even start with the last one. I think we get way too dependent on external libraries. So jQuery is the classic example. jQuery is a crutch. It's like, I needed to do something really, really tiny and simple on my site, so I included jQuery. And now there's another 80 kilobytes or however big the library is once you pull it in, dependency, and I've always got to pull in this external library with this external request and this external code, which could one day have a vulnerability. And now I've got to work with that, as opposed to, why didn't I just write like two lines of JavaScript? So we use it way too much as a crutch. I do have it on Have I Been Pwned because I use a lot of features within jQuery. I don't have it on TroyHunt.com, and when I need to do asynchronous gets and posts and things like that, I just use vanilla JS. And it's fine, and there's a very, very small bit of code. So I do agree that we use it too much as a crutch. I do not agree with the premise of just don't use these external libraries, because they do make a huge difference in terms of productivity. I mean, it'd be crazy to say you go and rewrite a whole bulk of what's in those jQuery libraries because you're using a whole bunch of async requests and you're using selectors and you're using transitions and all the other sorts of stuff which is built into the libraries. It doesn't make sense to go and rewrite all that. We're actually trying to get work done here and produce code. Knowing the difference of when to use the library and when to write your own stuff, I think that's the key. Now, the bit about never using external services just does not make sense. You know, think about the accessibility thing. We've got government departments like the ICO that need to be accessible if someone's visually impaired. This is not a negotiation. There is a legal requirement. Do you really think that the developers there trying to build out a website to give people information about data protection in the UK, should they really be going out and writing accessibility controls and writing a text-to-speech engine? Like, no, this is ridiculous. And we can't just embed one static library served from the site there. You're going to have a dependency on a server somewhere. So to suggest that you should never do that, it's like all blanket statements are bad, right? Like, this is crazy. We shouldn't be rewriting all this stuff, particularly when we have a combination of SRI and CSP to help us. So I really like to take the middle ground on many of these issues, which is that chucking it all out is ridiculous, and just loading it all with no protection whatsoever, we now know is ridiculous. This is why I think it's a watershed moment. Go and use the technologies that are there to better protect what we have and try and get the best of both worlds. So I hope that the watershed moment out of all this is we now realize that we have this risk with external dependencies, and per the title of the blog post, with the supply chain. When we are dependent on things upstream and they change, bad stuff happens. And also, let's be clear, nothing bad really happened as a result of this particular attack. A crypto miner ran. Some people's CPU went up just a little bit. But the attacker pushed this out on a Sunday morning, right, like the quietest possible time of the week, made it appear on everyone's machine so it was really easy to identify. Imagine it had have actually been something properly malicious. Everything from steal cookies to try and install malware on people, and then they had to try and obfuscate it. So imagine that they only ran it 10% of the time, and they didn't run it in the same browser twice, and they just did other things to obfuscate it. Like, we totally dodged the bullet on this. Like, we got away with this so, so cheaply when it could have been so, so bad. All right, so that's that. I know I've gone on about that for a little bit, but I think that it just calls into question the entire fabric of how we build a lot of these apps. Now, blog post two. The thing that was going to go out on Monday before I got totally derailed by crypto miners was making light of the dark web and debunking the FUD. And this is just one of these things that continually niggled away at me and bugged me over time. Until eventually there was a catalyst and I went, right, this is it. We've got to actually write something about this. And I start off this blog post by essentially talking about the way the security industry and particularly hackers are represented versus the reality. And I show a lot of hoodies. We know that hackers have hoodies because we see them all over the news the whole time. Hoodies, green screens. I talk about Cujo. Now, I've certainly used Cujo in many of my presentations before. It's in here as well. They start their talk out. In fact, I'm going to play the audio. They start this, I'll wait till it gets to the good bit. They start this presentation out by saying, you need to go and buy a Cujo. And the reason you need a Cujo is because there are hackers in your house trying to break into things. Now, let's have a look at this. It's very, very scary.
No, but you've probably already been hacked. Thousands of hacking attacks occur each day.
Scary, right? Thousands of hacking attacks occur each day, and there is a guy in the video with a hoodie trying to hack into your things on a green screen. And I point out that what he's actually doing is he's using HackerTyper. And if you go to HackerTyper.net now and just bash the keyboard, you'll see hacking all over the place. It's very, very, very amusing, actually. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of other examples here where I talk about the representation of security in hackers versus the reality. And I've got a couple of pasty-faced children images in here of the guys who were actually behind a lot of these attacks. And it's like, well, you know, the Lulzsec guy, I've got, who do I have here? Ryan Cleary, I think. Had Ryan Cleary in here. It's like, he's a child. I think he was 18 at the time he was involved in this. Now, obviously, he was getting involved in this stuff a lot younger as well. We've got the TalkTalk hacker in here. He was a 16-year-old kid when he hacked into TalkTalk. They can't show you his face because he's a freaking kid. And it's like, this is often the reality. And we're seeing the representation of hackers and the reality of hackers at different odds. And then I came across a tweet the other day where a particular company was talking about the amount of data they found on the dark web. And it sounded very, very scary. You know, dark web, must be some nasty stuff going on down there in the dark web. Dangerous place, dark web, probably hard to get to on the dark web. And it infuriated me because I went, well, hang on, I've been pwned. I've got a lot of millions of records, and in fact, a lot of billions of records in there. And just about nothing came from Tor hidden services. And this is effectively where we're going now. So this premise that all of this nasty stuff comes from this scary place. And what I wanted to do was sort of tackle this on two fronts. One front was to show that Tor is not necessarily a dark, scary place. So for example, I showed Facebook served over their Tor hidden service. And I log into my Facebook account and there's a photo of my little girl there who doesn't look very scary because she's freaking 5 years old. She does know how to use Hacker Typer, incidentally. So she's 5 years old and she's sitting there on this Tor hidden service, the dark web, which I'm accessing via the Tor browser, which is, for all intents and purposes, Firefox with some tweaks. So the dark web is very, very accessible. I show you the fact you can go to the dark web and buy orange Trump-shaped ecstasy tablets. True story. Check out the image in the blog post. I don't want to sort of laugh at like illegal drugs, but it's kind of funny to see ecstasy tablets shaped like Trump. But the point is that this is the sort of stuff that is available on the dark web, as well as things like the Ashley Madison data dump. So you could go to the dark web if you wanted to and download the Ashley Madison data, 30 million plus records, or you could Google the clear web and just download it from there. And this starts to sort of take us around now to the discussion about where data is found. A huge volume of data comes from publicly accessible locations on the clear web. The companies selling services saying that the data is from the dark web are finding a lot of it on the clear web. I'm finding a lot of it on the clear web. People are sending a lot of it to me that was exposed on the clear web. And I've got examples in here of things like that massive South African data breach where it was like every single person in South Africa, 55 million odd records in here. It was just exposed on a publicly facing file share. Red Cross data breach, the Red Cross blood service in Australia, publicly facing file server. The data was sitting in there. I mentioned Ashley Madison. That was just torrented extensively on the clear web. Attackers there wanted to redistribute it as much as possible. The 1.4 billion email address password pairs that was in the news early December, company said, we found it on the dark web. I've got an example of the Reddit post several days before they reported it, where the data is literally on Reddit. And that was the first place it appeared because the guy that created it went onto Reddit and said, hey, I just created this. All right, there's some kind of sleazy shit on Reddit, I guess, but it is the front page of the internet. It is clear web. It is massively mainstream. So to then have all of these headlines, file with 1.4 billion hacked and leaked passwords found on the dark web, archive of 1.4 billion credentials in clear text found in dark web archive, database of 1.4 billion credentials found on dark web. No, it's not. It's not on the dark web. I mean, maybe it is now, and maybe the company did actually find it on the dark web after someone copied it off the clear web and put it on the dark web. And there's almost a part of me which is like, I really don't care too much about the semantics. You know, like I don't honestly care too much whether they found it on the clear web or the dark web. I don't care if it was on someone's personal stash. Maybe they had it on a USB stick or something like that, and they handed it to a mate, and it was literally like sneakerware. That doesn't matter too much. But don't try and sell it as being something scarier than what it actually is. I talk a bit about the Experian dark web search. I think I've spoken about this before because I embedded some tweets of when I'd shared it. So it's a little bit have I been pwned, like where you go in and you enter your email address and go and search the dark web. You do have to agree to 21,494 words in the terms of use of agreement, the privacy policy, and the ad tracking policy before you search. Of course, everybody reads those and they then proceed with full awareness of how their data will be used. And then it comes back and says, well, we've searched the dark web. 2 days later, we've searched the dark web and we found you in some places, can't tell you where. And it is just infuriating to see this. Now, I am conscious that there are companies out there providing legitimate services and that dark web becomes a marketing term. And I get that. And look, there are certainly companies that I've worked with before. I think someone made the point of, do any of my sponsors actually use the term dark web? And I looked it up and yes, some of them have. So there are definitely legitimate organizations out there, but the term is hyperbolic. And the term is used to create fear and to, in my opinion, overinflate the actual risk involved to people. So I think where we might leave this one, and I kind of make a big comment about this in bold, is that If you're seeing a company try to sell you something based on anything dark web, just stop and have a think for a moment. Are they trying to sell you something? Is there a monetization aspect? What is the motive that they have for using that term? And indeed, does it actually come from the dark web? Or is the freaking thing on Reddit or a publicly exposed web server with directory listing enabled? Because it's probably going to be the latter. So, they are the things that have been written this week. Sponsor time. NetSparker is sponsoring me. They write software which can scan the dark web. No, I'm kidding. They write dynamic analysis security testing tool. And frankly, NetSparker is one of my favorite sponsors to talk about because I've actually used their gear for years and years and years. You can go back through my blog post to a time where certainly they weren't paying me anything to have the little text across the top of the screen. It's a tool that I still use today, and I do find it enormously useful because it works really well and it creates reports that people understand. So you can take it, point it at your www.whatever, and it will go through and test for everything from SQL injection through to cookies not flagged as HTTP only, through to finding exposed GitHub repositories on your site, because believe it or not, people do publish their entire GitHub repository to the root of their website. I think they basically just pick up the whole thing, FTP it, job done. So they're up there today. Now, a little taster for what is going to come next week. My Pwned Passwords version 2 is almost done. I've got all the data. It's a lot. I'm not going to tell you how much. I'm going to announce that next week. So that's almost done. One thing I have been talking about on Twitter yesterday and today, because I wanted to crowdsource some opinions, is that what I'm doing with V2, among other sorts of features, is giving you an idea of how frequently the password has appeared publicly. And originally what I was thinking of doing is just ordering it from like the most sort of found password through to the least. So for example, ABC123 might have appeared tens of thousands of times in the data that I've pulled in. A bunch of other stuff would have appeared once or twice. I'm still figuring out exactly what to do. Like, do I just put it in an order or do I give the raw number of how many times it's appeared? I'm leaning a little bit towards the latter now, primarily because I've realized that there's a huge portion of the data, I think it's something like about a third, where the password has only appeared once. So if I was going to do an order, it's like you're left with the whole bottom order. Yeah, it might be, what's the right way of putting this? I'm left with like a third of the data, which implies it's ordered in severity, but actually is equal. So that's why I might just provide the number as well. One of the things I'm also thinking about, and this is what I was trying to crowdsource this morning, is that when you do a search on Have I Been Pwned, because there's a place you can put a password in, and we're going to talk next week about what you should and should not enter in there and what controls and protections there are. And it comes back and says, at the moment, it just comes back and says either the password's been seen before or it hasn't. But of course, now I can give a severity rating to it. And I'm trying to figure out the right way of representing severity so that it's clear and not misleading. So for example, some people said, well, you should use like green, amber, red kind of indicators. And I don't want to do that because the reality of it is the password's now public. There is no green, there is no amber. It's bad. It's just that like some obscure sequence of strings is not as bad as ABC123. So what I'm leaning towards at the moment is poop emojis. And someone suggested this and a few people chimed in. They went, yeah, you should do this. So there's like one poop emoji if it's appeared once, and then there's two poop emojis if it's appeared 20 times, and there's three poop emojis if it's appeared heaps. And I'm also thinking about actually representing a number. So how many times did it appear? If you have brilliant ideas about that, look at my Twitters from today because I've been tweeting, asking people. I've got some screen mock-ups in there as well. I'd love to hear from you. If you are someone who actually specializes in UX and you know how to do this in a way that makes sense to the masses, I'd also love to hear from you. So I might share a bit more around that today. That will be out there in some form or another next week, barring anything going wrong. There are a couple of dependencies I need to get sorted out first. But hopefully next week when I'm doing this update, we'll be talking about Pwned Passwords version 2. You'll be able to download them all again. As I said, there's a heap more of them. There's actually some indication of prevalence or severity or whatever we want to call it. There's going to be a really cool anonymity thing and a really cool partnership to talk about as well. So all of that should be out next week. I'm going to kill this video now and actually go back to trying to build out what those poop emojis should look like. Thanks very much for listening.